Maharaj. Yes, so I'm going to start today with the attempts to legalise euthanasia in New Zealand. Now, I suppose where this address fits into the rest of your agenda for the weekend is that this is a one way in which we're seeing ethics in action. This is the bottom line, really. When all the theories are said and done with, what actually happens in the real world, where people are trying to define positions for themselves, and then, in fact, to influence everybody else's position. And so this is the ground of ethics, the bottom line. Well, now this slide here shows, yes, that there have been three attempts to legalise euthanasia in New Zealand. The first one was when Michael Laws introduced his Death with Dignity Bill in 1995. And that failed to pass the first reading by a vote of 61 to 29. He was a controversial figure, and he still is. And he was known to favour extending assisted suicide to children. Both of those things counted against the success of his bill. Then Peter Brown introduced a second Death with Dignity Bill in 2003. In the previous 4 years, there had been five cases of husbands killing their sick wives in the name of mercy killing. Now, these cases were used by the Voluntary Euthanasia Society and its supporters to rally public opinion in favour of decriminalising euthanasia. And opposition to that bill wasn't as well organised as the first one, which was a serious oversight, really, on our part. Nevertheless, it was defeated at the first reading by a small margin of one vote. And the third and most recent attempt to do this is Private Member's Bill sponsored by Labour MP Marianne Street in 2012-2013. And rather than use the term euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide or death with dignity, she elected to call it the End of Life Choice Bill. And that was deposited in the parliamentary ballot system early in 2012, but very fortunately, it failed to be drawn for debate, and she removed it again in October of last year on political grounds. But I think actually what happened was that her Labour colleagues counselled her that if the bill was to come forward for debate in this period now before the election, it could create serious disadvantages for the Labour Party, and so she was persuaded to withdraw it. Now, one has to give credit where credit is due. Pro-euthanasia organisations never rest in their mission. So, for example, in Holland, the organisation there has just recently set up six vans to go out on the road with nurses and doctors, and they can provide you with your euthanasia at home, particularly valuable in situations where your doctor has decided that actually that's not the most appropriate thing for you to do. And in Oregon, the state of Oregon, in the United States, there is a voluntary organisation called Compassion in Dying, which will put you, if you're applying for euthanasia or assisted suicide, they'll put you in contact with the nearest doctor who is favourable towards euthanasia, and thereby help you to expedite your death. So they never stop. And that's presumably why New Zealand public has largely shown that it favours euthanasia. Yeah, and you'll see in that slide there a number of public polls that have been carried out over the years, and how the percentage supporting euthanasia has risen from 61% to 82%. Now, the questions that are asked in these polls are usually quite simple questions and couched in emotive terms. For example, this is one that was posed at one stage. Suppose a person has a painful, incurable disease. Do you think that doctors should be allowed by law to end the patient's life if the patient requests it? There's been quite a bit of study done on the public polls, and we now realise that the way the question is worded depends, or at least the answer depends on the way the question is worded. And if you ask a question like, if you had a terminal disease, would you request a doctor to end your life? The positive responses come down to about 10%. So there's quite a big range there. So that's one of the issues. The other issue is that most New Zealanders don't have the faintest idea of what actually would be entailed if this bill were to become law, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a few minutes. Another major factor in New Zealand which is pushing public opinion the way it is the role of the media. And the media is, as far as we can tell, keen on promoting active euthanasia. I'm not just sure what the reasoning is behind it, but it's very difficult for us to get material into the press, into the into television and so on, whereas it seems to be no problem for pro-euthanasia people. So increasingly we're having to turn our attention to the social media, to Twitter and Facebook and so on, which may in the end be a better bet than the press anyway. Now, as far as New Zealand doctors are concerned, there have been three surveys that I'm aware of. The most recent one happened last year, and I don't think it's been published yet. I'm not sure, I haven't seen it, but somebody else put me right on that. It was done by a group at Auckland University. And you can see that there is evidence here that although the New Zealand Medical Association, which represents a majority of doctors, doesn't support the legalisation of euthanasia, there is evidence that some medical practitioners don't support that official line. And there was a survey done of Waikato doctors a few years ago where 17 of them admitted to assisting a patient to die. But when you look at the survey, it's not clear that they actually knew what they were talking about, whether it was euthanasia or whether it was really just appropriate withdrawal of treatment for a person who was terminal. The big one was the 2003 one, surveying 2,600 GPs. They found that 693 of the 11,000 who had access to a patient prior to death in the last year had made at least one medical decision about the end of life. These included increasing pain relief, withdrawing or withholding medications and so on. Of the 693 GPs who'd done those sort of things, 39, that's 5.6%, responded yes to a question that asked, with respect to the last patient death you were involved with in the preceding 12 months, was that death caused by a drug prescribed, supplied or administered with the explicit purpose of hastening the end of life or enabling the patient to end their own life? So there is probably a small group of New Zealand GPs who have actually at some stage assisted a person to terminate their life, probably in a way which we would call euthanasia. And interestingly enough, as you can see there are quite a number of doctors did not actually discuss these issues with their patients before they gave them the medication to end their lives. Now, the advocates of euthanasia ask, given that the practice is already widespread, which I don't believe it is, but that's what they say, surely the right thing to do is to legalise it so that these doctors who are doing it are not facing the possibility of prosecution. It seems to me to be a strange argument. These doctors are breaking the law. It seems to me that the right thing to do would be for these doctors to own up and to be prosecuted, and let's see what the law says about it. The other assumption, of course, that is made when pro-euthanasia people make those statements is that doctors will actually abide by the new rules. But we know that there are doctors here who are not obeying the rules now, the legislation as it is now, which says actually that euthanasia is murder. And they are the doctors who will no doubt step over the boundary and start doing other things like euthanizing people without their consent or request. So, just a little bit about taking the fight to the opposition. Yes, there's a group of organisations there, as you see on that slide, that are trying to do that. The international organisation is the Euthanasia Prevention Organisation, based in Canada. And the rest of us are affiliated with that. We've got some very good colleagues in Australia and in Canada and the United States and now in Europe who are working with us. We're trying to pool our resources, our ideas, technology and so on to actually begin to make an important international contribution to the debate. The president of the International Euthanasia Prevention Coalition is Alex Schadenberg. Sorry, I'm not sure where he's gone to. Maybe you saw him already. Okay. Well, now I just want to have a brief look at the end-of-life choice bill. We don't have time to look at it in detail, so I'm just going to make 4 points.
And I think I've got a bit too...
There
he is there.
Right, here are 4 points about this bill. It's a very radical bill in terms of the range of conditions that will be eligible for assisted suicide or euthanasia. It offers no guarantee against eventually allowing non-voluntary or involuntary killing. Despite the presence of a conscience clause, any doctor may be forced to participate in the process, at least indirectly, and there are absolutely no controls on doctors who choose to undertake it.
Would you just describe the point one, what the conditions are? Could you just elaborate point one a little bit about what...
Yes, I'm going to come to that. Yes, I'm going to elaborate on all of these points. Right, so now with respect to the grounds for request, Section 6 allows anybody who is over the age of 18 and is mentally competent, who suffers from either a terminal disease or other medical condition likely to end his or her life within 12 months, or suffers from an irreversible physical or mental medical condition that in the person's view renders his or her life unbearable, would be qualified to request and receive medical assistance to end his or her life, which is a euphemism, of course, for either euthanasia or assisted suicide. Now, the reasons why we oppose the bill start with the grounds for request. That third indication, suffers from an irreversible physical or medical condition, which in the person's view renders his or her life unbearable, could be justified by the descriptors offered for virtually any human condition, including loneliness, depression, poor family relationships, tired of living, feelings of helplessness, demoralisation syndrome, loss of dignity, post-traumatic stress disorder and fear of future pain. So really thousands of people, not all of them seriously ill, will fall under this category where, as in Belgium and Holland, euthanasia becomes a panacea for all manner of social ills, including box sex change operations. You may have seen that one recently. In this respect, this bill offers from the outset what it took the Dutch 30 years to accomplish. And it seems to us that if this bill goes ahead, New Zealand will increasingly become mired in a culture of death. We'll talk a bit more about some of these excesses in a minute. Now, it's interesting that insufferable, unrelievable pain is not selected for specific mention in this bill. And that's because its authors know two things. First of all, that palliative care is capable of stopping the so-called unrelieved pain. And secondly, they also have learned from the data in Oregon State in the United States that pain is virtually never the reason for requesting assisted suicide. In fact, one senior doctor has said that in the last 10 years, not a single person has requested assisted suicide on account of unrelieved pain. So the goalposts have been subtly moved to permit existential suffering to be the main indication, whilst allowing the general public to go on worrying about the pain. So we're talking now really about things fear as a problem. So that's now the new type of suffering. Existential suffering is about suffering which isn't actually related to a physical illness. So it's that sort of suffering now which the pro-euthanasia people are beginning to talk about. So that's one big problem. The next one is that with respect to the likelihood of abuse by health staff, we've got the experience of Belgium, Holland and Oregon to go on. In Belgium, last year, 30% of reported assisted deaths were performed without the patient's request. Physicians are said to frequently forget to obtain the patient's request before ending their lives. In Holland, in 2010, more than 350 people were given assisted death without explicit request. and many hundreds more were killed by deep sedation after their doctor decided that their quality of life was substandard. Deep sedation is a kind of a procedure based on what used to be called the Liverpool pathway, whereby a person is given sedation and then they die because of dehydration and lack of nutrition. But what's happening now in Belgium, whereas that can be a very useful program for people in palliative care, in Belgium it's being used for others who are not actually in danger of dying. So what that says to us is that although in Holland and Belgium and Oregon there are strict rules about what can be done and what can't be done, what's applicable, what should be allowed and what's not allowed, in fact doctors are always stepping over the line and doing things to people that are not actually legal, but nobody is actually doing anything about that, and I'll tell you about why that is in a minute. So that's the first level of abuse. The second level is the recording of deaths by people who are doing euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide. It's thought that up to 40% of episodes go unreported. In fact, some physicians have confessed never to have reported one. So really the authorities have no idea what's happening. And the Oregon Public Health Service made a statement a few years ago that they hadn't got the faintest idea how their bill was working out in practice because it just didn't have the reports to tell them. And so I think we've got to reject this bill principally because it will impact adversely on public safety. Now, with respect to the conscience clause, sorry, I keep on getting behind. Right, there we go. With respect to the conscience clause, section 27 allows people, doctors, not to participate directly or indirectly in any aspects of this act. That's a quote. A person who refuses to participate does not have to give any reason for refusing. However, a medical practitioner who receives a request for euthanasia but declines to be involved must refer the person to another medical practitioner who is willing to comply with the person's request and carry out medically assisted death in accordance with the Act. So that's really forcing doctors into indirect participation. So despite saying that you're not required to participate either directly or indirectly, the truth of the matter is that you are required to refer somebody on. So if a doctor failed to do that, then it could be that that doctor would be prosecuted under Section 30, which states that if anyone attempts to interfere with a person's decision to end their life, they could find themselves prosecuted and face a $10,000 fine or 3 months in jail or both. So doctors don't actually have too much wriggle room. So I think we reject the bill because it will force all doctors to at least indirectly be involved in euthanizing patients. Now this section implies that some medical practitioners will become recognised as euthanasia friendly, as has happened to Oregon and elsewhere. And it's likely, I think, that in New Zealand we'd find voluntary organisations setting up advisory and assistance schemes to direct potential applicants for euthanasia to these doctors. It's happened everywhere else. Now with respect to the legal consequences, section 26, what is going on here? Can somebody just help me to get back to where we were? No, that's not it either. I want to go back. We should be on slide 37. Yeah, that's one before that. Is there one before that? Oh, yeah, the next one. Go to the next one. That's right. Yeah. Okay. No, when we come back, this go ahead, not back. Here we are. That's the one. Okay, this is the really radical clause in the bill. Section 26 grants immunity from civil or criminal liability to any person for any act done or omission made while acting in good faith when assisting or participating in implementing any aspect of the act. This applies despite the person having inadvertently failed to comply fully with any requirement of the act. So despite all the assurances that we're getting about legislating for a tight protective safety net around the practice of assisted suicide, we discover that there's this huge gap in it. That provides this, that anybody who is doing euthanasia, provided they shelter under the mantra, I was acting in good faith, whatever that means, is free of any threat of prosecution. And even if they fail to comply fully with the requirements of the Act, they're still not held responsible. And of course that allows enormous flexibility in the use of euthanasia, because there's nobody there keeping an eye on anyone to make sure that they're actually sticking to the rules. In Holland and Belgium, this has happened. They use the mantra force majeure, which means roughly there was no option. It's been used by doctors for years to justify any kind of application, including euthanizing people who didn't request or consent to it, which actually is illegal in Holland, but nobody is prosecuted for it. So that means that medical practitioners who kill patients under the guise of euthanasia will be protected from disciplinary proceedings by hospital boards, the Health and Disability Commissioner, the Medical Council, and even the police. They will have far greater protection under the law than will the medical practitioners who treated the patient prior to their request for euthanasia. And so we oppose this bill because it will effectively give doctors a license to kill that will eventually have grave consequences for their clinical judgment and the morality of their decisions. You may have noticed in the newspapers just the last few days that the intensive care specialists in Belgium have unilaterally decided that they have the power to kill people actively if they feel that they're not making satisfactory progress in intensive care. And that's the sort of thing that will happen here. There's no question about that. So now there are other reasons that we've got for rejecting the initiative. Just look at those very quickly. If I can hit the right button. Yeah. Okay, the right to die will become a duty to die. As people feel pressured by their families and by the community. I don't know whether you read Dame Jenny Gibbs's outburst about euthanasia last year. She promotes euthanasia because she says she doesn't believe that the country will be able to support all these 100-year-old people in coming years. And so she obviously has something in the back of her mind that euthanasia would be good, a good economic benefit, or could provide a good economic benefit for the country. We don't even have voluntary euthanasia yet. So it puts pressure on vulnerable people who don't want to be a burden. It'll be abused by some health professionals. It'll be impossible to limit its application for an increasingly wide range of indications. There'll be conflicts of duty for health staff. And one that's not very often talked about, but there will be problems for people who are misdiagnosed or whose prognosis is wrong, and there will be unnecessary deaths. I think the trade union leader, Matt McCartan, is a good example of that. He was told 6 years ago that he had 6 weeks to live because of his cancer, sold up all his gear, went and lived with his brother, John, and now he's just been appointed big chief in the Labour Party. So he's a very good example of that. And I remember years ago, a GP, when we were running palliative care beds at North Shore Hospital, a GP being referred to us by another hospital for palliative care because he had gastric cancer. And after 3 or 4 weeks, we found that he wasn't actually dying. And so we did another gastroscopy, discovered that his gastric cancer had dropped, had shrunk to a little wee thing like that. And then we discovered that the other hospital hadn't actually biopsied it. When we biopsied the thing, we found it was just chronic gastric ulcer. So we had to tell this man he wasn't going to die and he wasn't all that happy about it. Time. Now, I just would like to switch over. Can we switch over just quickly to the next one, the theology ones? I just want to run through some ideas, some theological ideas that I've had, which have... which have some bearing on this. I don't have any notes here, so I'll just... could you just push them on for me? Okay. Well, now, here we have what I think are some important theological precepts that we should consider. First of all, that we endorse the concept of the deepest respect for life from its beginning in utero to its natural end, because we believe that humankind is unique, created by God in his own image. So we hold that it's only with the greatest temerity that anyone would terminate a life that God has brought into being with the intention that it should at least have some of his attributes. Next one. Jesus never promoted death over life. There's no example of Jesus ever killing anybody. But the example of Jesus in curing people, healing people, I think is a very good model for those of us in the medical profession to try and improve the quality of life for the suffering. Next one. Yeah, the commandment, thou shalt not kill, still remains a guiding precept for our culture. Some of the pro-euthanasia people point to instances, for example, in Exodus 21, I think it is, where God requires that certain people, who, like people who have murdered other people, will themselves be put to death. And they say that that's actually a good precedent for euthanasia. Well, it's rubbish. And there's no reason at all why anyone should think that the sanctions that God uses against people or recommends against people should be sanctions that we use against people. Right, next one. Jesus was always concerned for the disadvantaged. We should be too, and elder abuse is one of the big issues of society today. Age Concern tell me that they have 4 new references, referrals for elder abuse each day around New Zealand. So it's a big issue. And the epidemic of elder abuse really suggests to many people in that age group that they're not wanted. And that could become a very serious issue. Although I've been a geriatrician for 20 years, and I've seen so much of this myself, where families just rip off their parents, physically abuse them, psychologically abuse them, and so on. But we as Christians should be concerned about the disadvantage of society. Next one. Well, this, I think, is a very important one. Jesus' parable of the Good Samaritan condemns by implication those who speak in humanitarian terms about compassion and are not prepared to make the personal sacrifices of time, finance, and personal attention needed to comfort dying people. I've just been reading a book by a fellow who regards himself as a liberal atheist. And he says, he's written an interesting thing. He says here that the projection of fears and anxieties onto the dying is what powers so-called compassion in pro-euthanasia organisations. Self-pity motivates campaigners to call for a change in the law and not an increase in compassionate acts by caring persons, which is the real meaning of compassion. True compassion is beyond the realms of legislation. And I had an interesting example of that. I was speaking at a public meeting in Hastings a few weeks ago, and there were some voluntary euthanasia society supporters there, and one lady stood up and she said, I had to go and visit a rest home, and she gave the name of the rest home, which I now forget, which specializes in caring for disabled people. And she said, I was so disgusted, I wished that I could put them all down right then. And I said, well, that's exactly why we don't want euthanasia to be legalised here, because we'd have people like you going around doing that sort of thing all the time. Okay, next one. Yes, Christians endorse the principle that they have an obligation to share and share alike by bearing one another's burdens. It cuts across the ethos of self-interest, which some people have regarded as making us one of the most narcissistic societies in the world, looking after our own interests, failing to look after the interests of others who are in need. And it's that sort of thing which causes the loneliness and neglect that turns people towards euthanasia. Next one. We've only got 9 of these, so we're just about at the end. Christians are prepared to allow God to determine their end. I think you're all familiar with that concept. And finally, by his courage in facing his forthcoming death, Jesus gives us courage. He trusted his Father to see him through the most awful death experience At the cross, Jesus surrendered his autonomy to do his Father's will. Now, it's very interesting that up till now, up till very recently, autonomy has been one of the key reasons that people request or think we should legalize euthanasia. And in most places around the world, people are still saying that. But Baroness Mary Warnock of the UK, who has been one of the main forces behind pushing for legalization, she said this recently: "Everybody knows that in a civilized society subject to the rule of law, one can't always have autonomy. One has to give up some freedoms to obey the law. I don't think the principle of patient autonomy is really a very strong ground for assisted dying." Well, that's revelationary, because if they think that, then what are the grounds for assisted dying? Because once you do away with compassion and once you do away with autonomy, there's very little left. And this fellow Yule writes, "Whereas much of the assisted suicide lobby sees itself as liberating, ridding citizens of pointless laws based on outmoded morals, systems that prevent individuals from doing what they wish, they in reality are calling for government assistance, since doctors are representatives of government, and further regulation of a sphere formerly administered privately." He makes the point, if autonomy were the basis for the ability to obtain assistance to die, we should honour all requests to die from competent individuals. And in some places they're even talking about honouring requests that have never been made by non-competent individuals on the grounds of discrimination. So you can just see really how that the whole issue of legalizing euthanasia can just run out of hand and swamp a country with what we think is really an ethos of death rather than ethos of life. A Dutch physician called Richard Fennixon said this recently: "Euthanasia and assisted suicide do not just offer additional management options in medicine, they replace medicine." And I think that's not a bad summary of the situation. I think I'll leave it at that, except to say that I've brought with me some of our brochures, which you're welcome to take some, keep for yourself, give away to others. We'll put them on the front chairs here. These ones are 8 dangers of legal euthanasia that's for secular use. I've got a few here of the next one we're putting out, which is not printed yet. And this is the one I've been showing you here on the board: 9 applied theological reasons why Christians should reject euthanasia, whether or not it's legalized. That one will be printed hopefully in the next few weeks. And I've also got some cards here if any of you are wanting to get in touch with me or our organization. The address is on there. Thanks very much. Time for morning tea.